tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Last night during the question and answer session, there was one of the questions asking for a sutta or a reference of a sutta that talked about path and fruit, and the stages liberation and sort of the path of liberation and the fruit of that liberation. So that I went back last night and sort of scoured some books and the question the other night, what's fun about being a monk? I had fun last night. this sutta comes in. Probably people would have heard it referenced in different places, where it's the Buddha is giving a discourse about the eight wonderful and marvelous qualities of the great ocean, and one of them, which is well known, is that the great ocean has but one taste, the taste of salt. And then that's compared to just as the great ocean has but one taste, the taste of salt, even so this Dhamma discipline, which is what the Buddha called his dispensation, this Dhamma discipline has but one taste, the taste of liberation. The eighth quality, and just as the great ocean is the abode of vast creatures, even so is this Dhamma discipline the domain of great beings, the stream enterer and one practicing for the realization of the fruit of stream entry, the once returner and one practicing for the realization of the fruit of once returning, the non-returner and one practicing for the realization of the fruit of non-returning, arahant and one practicing for arahantship. This is the eighth wonderful and marvelous quality in this Dhamma discipline, which the monks perceive again and again, by reason of which they take delight in it. That is in the numerical discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya, and it's in the eights and sutta number 19, for those who are taking notes. And as I was poking around, I came across a really quite a delightful sutta that I thought I would read this morning, which is also concerning the the fruits of realization, in particular that first entry into the interrealization of stream entry. And on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Kapilavatu in the Banyan Tree Monastery. That was his hometown. Then Mahanama the Sakyan approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side. So seated, he said to the Blessed One, Lord, in what way does a noble disciple often dwell when he has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching? So that realization of stream entering. When Mahanama, a noble disciple, has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching, he often dwells in such a way as this. Here a noble disciple recollects the Tathagata thus, the Blessed One is an Arahant, fully enlightened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the world, unsurpassed leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas and humans, the enlightened one, the Blessed One. When a noble disciple recollects the Tathagata thus, on that occasion, his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, or delusion. His mind is straight, with the Tathagata as its object. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains the inspiration of the meaning, the inspiration of the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he is gladdened, rapture arises. For one uplifted by rapture, the body becomes calm. One calm in body feels happy. For one who is happy, the mind becomes concentrated. This is called a noble disciple who dwells evenly amidst an uneven generation, who dwells unafflicted amidst an afflicted generation, who has entered upon the stream of the Dhamma and develops recollection of the Buddha. Further, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects the Dhamma thus. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One, directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, worthy of application, to be personally experienced by the wise. When a noble disciple recollects the Dhamma thus, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, and delusion. His mind is straight with Dhamma as its object, and repeats those. This is called a noble disciple who dwells evenly amidst an uneven generation, who dwells unafflicted amidst an afflicted generation, who has entered upon the stream of the Dhamma and develops recollection of the Dhamma. Further, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects the Sangha thus. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way. That is, the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. When a noble disciple recollects the Sangha thus, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, or delusion, and so on. This is a noble disciple who dwells evenly amidst an uneven generation, who has entered upon the stream of the Dhamma and develops recollection of the Sangha. Further, Mahanama, a noble disciple recollects his own virtues thus. I possess the virtues dear to the noble ones, unbroken, untorn, unblemished, unmottled, freeing, praised by the wise, unadhered to, leading to concentration. When a noble disciple recollects his own virtues thus, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, or delusion. And so on. This is called a noble disciple who has entered upon the stream of the Dhamma and develops recollection of virtue. Further, Mahanama, a noble disciple recollects his own generosity thus. It is a gain for me, it is well gained by me, that in a generation obsessed by the stain of stinginess, I dwell at home with a mind devoid of the stain of stinginess, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, one devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. When a noble disciple recollects his own generosity thus, on that occasion, his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, or delusion. And so on. This is called a noble disciple who has entered upon the stream of the Dhamma and develops recollection of generosity. Further, Mahanama, a noble disciple, develops the recollection of the devas thus. There are devas in the heaven of the four great kings, Tavatinksa devas, Yama devas, Tusita devas, devas who delight in creation, devas who control what is created by others, devas of Brahma's company, and devas still higher than these. There is found in me such faith as those devas possessed, because of which, when they passed away from this world, they were reborn there. There is found in me such virtue, such learning, such generosity, such wisdom as those devas possessed, because of which, when they passed away from this world, they were reborn there. When a noble disciple recollects his own faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom, as well as those of the devas, on that occasion, his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, or delusion. His mind is straight, with those virtues as its object. A noble disciple whose mind is straight thus gains the inspiration of the meaning, the inspiration of the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he is gladdened, rapture arises. For one uplifted by rapture, the body becomes calm. One calm in body feels happy. For one who is happy, the mind becomes concentrated. This is called a noble disciple who dwells evenly amidst an uneven generation, who dwells unafflicted amidst an afflicted generation, who has entered upon the stream of the Dhamma and develops recollection of the devas. A noble disciple, Mahanama, who has arrived at the fruit and understanding and understood the teaching, often dwells in just this way. Couldn't resist sharing that one. I think one of the, there's many striking things, but one of the things that I like to point out to people, particularly in terms of meditation, and that in that sequence, there's that, say, recollection of, say, those different recollections, and then there's gladness connected with the Dhamma arising. And then when there's gladness, then rapture arises. When one is uplifted by rapture, the body becomes calm. When one is calm in body, one feels happy. For one who is happy, the mind becomes concentrated. And that's usually backwards from how we usually approach our meditation, in the sense of, God, when I get my samadhi down, then I'm going to be happy. You know? And then all the effort is put into trying to get the mind to comply with one's wish to be concentrated and still. So that paying attention to those qualities that bring a sense of well-being, gladness, calmness, happiness, allowing that calming to take place, and the concentration arises out of that. And of course, the metta bhavana is a really fine example of things that bring gladness to the mind, a sense of gladdening the mind with using loving kindness as an object and a recollection, bringing that up. So that is a way of establishing well-being and then allowing the mind to settle from there. And then also, I think on a certain level, that gladness connected with the Dhamma is also seeing more clearly how these different things fit together. Well, what's the obstruction to that cultivation of loving kindness? And almost invariably, it'll be the sense of self that impinges on consciousness. And it usually doesn't just impinge on consciousness. It just looms. So that reflecting on the nature of how we construct a sense of self, and how that sense of self is a burden, how and that reflection on in terms of Dhamma, just on around the five khandhas, that it's like when we do the morning chanting, the going through all of the different aspects of what is suffering, and then it sort of ties it all up, saying that In brief, the five focuses of the grasping mind are dukkha. So that recognition of these panchupadana khanda, the aggregates of being, but aggregates of being that are affected by grasping, by clinging, by attachment, and that identification with the body, identification with feeling, identification with perception, identification with mental formations, identification with consciousness. It's sort of that act or activity, that habit of attachment and clinging is what is intrinsically bound up with suffering, dissatisfaction, discontent, and then that spills out into all the various forms of sort of afflicted emotional states. So that just investigation around those five aggregates of being, those five khandhas, and there's a discourse where the Buddha talks about he gives the image of a dog being tied to a post, and you know, whether that dog lies down, stands up, sits, walks, it walks tied to that post, and the Buddha says, as long as we're still sort of bound up and tied to the sort of identification with the five khandhas, identification with the body, feeling, perception, mental formations and consciousness, whether we walk, whether we stand, whether we sit, whether we lie down, we're bound with suffering, bound with discontent, dissatisfaction, dukkha, and that whole process of identification with the body, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. You know, this is mine. This is what I am. This is myself. And it's inevitably productive of suffering. It's just inherent. It's intrinsic. It can't be any other way. So that the recognition of how that clinging and attachment and identification keeps being coalescing and forming and establishing itself, and then recognizing that there is an opportunity of just non-clinging, non-attachment. And you think, how do I do that? You know, how do I not cling to everything that I conceived of myself? And you know, it's like, you know, if you've ever gone on a hike, a long hike, and you've taken too much stuff. And you know, when you put that pack on, it's a bit heavy. Yeah, it's okay. But you keep walking, and that pack gets heavier, and it keeps getting heavier. And they say, "Well, I can't go. I shouldn't have taken this much stuff. I really shouldn't have taken it. But maybe I'll need it." You know, you keep carrying it, and you keep carrying it. God, I got to get rid of some of this stuff. And it's just, you know, it's gone because you can't carry it any longer. And, you know, that's the same thing with that attachment and clinging. When you really realize, God, this is a burden, I don't want to carry it any longer, you're willing to put it down. You're willing to get rid of it, willing to drop it. So that that's the good news. The bad news is we usually have to wait until it's just really, really heavy before we're willing to put it down. The Buddha had us reflect and investigate on these aspects of the khandhas, and just to reflect on their emptiness or their sort of ephemeral nature, and the Buddha gave the images of it was actually the discourse start. He began the discourse where they were by a river, and as happens oftentimes in a river, there'll be some sort of foam or something on there, and the Buddha used that as an example, saying, "Well, can you see that foam on the river there?" He said, "That's just like our body. It's just, that foam is insubstantial and kind of empty, you know, hollow. You know, in the same way, our body." It's just like that. You reflect on the nature of the body. I mean, it seems substantial, but you know, as you age or have sickness or reflect on it more deeply, so, yeah, there's really nothing much here. All the different kinds of cells and whatnot, but it's really insubstantial. The nature of feeling, Buddha compared it to the, like in the, especially in Asia when they have the monsoon season and the rain comes in, you know, big heavy fat drops, when the water comes down, there'll be little bubbles will come up, and that feeling is like those bubbles because they're. A little bubble forms and it bursts, and a bubble forms and it bursts, and a little bubble forms and it bursts. And it's exactly like feelings. You think of the and feeling and feel. And it's good to clarify. You know, we use sort of Buddhist jargon oftentimes. You get used to using it, but feeling is very specific in the sense of pleasant, painful, neutral feeling. It's your basic response to. It's not sort of feelings in terms of emotion. It's your basic sort of tone of experience of pleasant, painful, neutral. So that with any experience, there's a feeling tone to things. It's whether sight, smell, sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, mind objects, and there's an associated feeling tone to it. But because those experiences are sort of arising and ceasing, the actual feeling tone is arising and ceasing. There's little bubbles arising and popping. And you know, we tend to, of course, react or respond to them in with our preferences and whatnot. So it ends up layering just that very simple feeling tone with our likes or dislikes, or wanting, not wanting. But that's, if we reflect, well, all there is just that basic feeling arising and ceasing. The perception. Perception is, the Buddha compares it to a mirage. Like in the hot season in India, hot, very hot sun. If you're here in America, then maybe somewhere out on the plains, or maybe central. I guess the Central Valley, you'd probably get some decent enough heat going to have a mirage. You know, those images that are, sort of shimmer a mirage in the distance, and it looks like something. As you get closer, it's not that. And that's what our and perception is also bound with memory, sort of memory perception, giving meaning to things, which we build, of course, through memory and perception. And, we give value and importance to things, how we hold it, and that's the nature of perception. And that's not a, say, there's not really a thinking process going on with that. We perceive something in a particular way affected by memory and then how we've conceived it over time as well. Ajahn Amaro recently gave a talk that he was relating the experience that he'd had when he went to England to do when he was a young monk, he did a long walk from the south of England up to the borders of Scotland, where there was from one of the monasteries in the first monastery, Chitterhurst, that was established in the south of England, and there was a branch monastery established up near the Scottish border. And after he finished his fifth rains, which is a time when monks have the opportunity to spread their wings a bit, and then he decided to try a walk in England, and he went with another layman. And then this past spring, the two of them got together again and then sort of went back and revisited this walk. And they didn't do the whole thing, they did parts of it. And it's sort of 25 years, 25th anniversary of their sort of quite historic sort of walk. And other monks had tried some short little walks, but that was the first time that anybody tried a really long walk. It took them a few months. But he said the really interesting thing is that virtually every place that he went back to, they moved something. They moved the hill. They moved the house. They moved... it had been so vivid in his memory, and he told the story so many times. But when he actually went back, then it wasn't actually how he remembered it or how he, related it to people, and it was different. Sanya anicca, the perception is impermanent. We tend to the perception is not just a a mechanical function that has no imprint on it. It's the upadana khanda, the aggregate of being affected by attachment and clinging, and whether our clinging is out of like or dislike or some kind of delusion or whatever. I mean, it's all. It doesn't have to be gross. I mean, oftentimes we pick up the gross things, but it's the subtle ones that are really believable, and then we build on them and they become reality. And that is the unfortunate circumstance of us as human beings, that we live in a world that we've actually created. And that's sort of what our wish of, boy, if I could just build the world, to make the world the way I wanted it. And then it would, wow, that'd be great. But the reality of suffering is you actually have to live in that world. So that perception is one of the key fundamental things that we build the world out of, our identification with self, my position, my preference, my idea, my ideal, my fear, it's not really thought through. It's not really. It plays much more. It's a much more deeper sort of stratum of the mind, of our thinking and planning and whatnot. But it overlays everything. So the Buddha, this is a reflect on the nature of these aggregates of being. Reflect on the nature of perception. Perception is like a mirage. This is the. It may not be the way we conceive it. The Buddha compared the mental formations to a banana tree, a plantain tree. He said, so a person goes into the forest looking for a heartwood, looking for a good solid tree, and it goes and cuts down a plantain tree and banana tree. And anybody's ever seen a banana tree, you see, it's leaves after leaves after leaves. There's no core to it. It's built, it's solid. They can be like yay big, 6, 8 inches, 10 inches, 12 inches around. Big, solid. But as you take a layer after layer after layer, you can peel it all back and there's nothing there. It's just another leaf inside that's gone around, so that the nature of our thought, mental formations, thought processes, there's just these layers. There's no solid core there. What is my one true thought? Yeah, well, good luck. So which doesn't mean one can't use thought, and that's actually like the mental formations. That's where, say, emotion, thought, planning, all of that takes place within that mental formations, and it can be irritation, aversion, ill will, desire, attachment, fear, anxiety. But it can also, mindfulness is a mental formation. Wisdom is a mental formation. Loving kindness is a mental formation. Compassion, these are equanimity, these are all mental formations. But they have a usefulness, they have a skill, a skillfulness to it, they have a beneficial result. So that, one day, one doesn't just sort of, mental formation, you're just like a banana tree, nothing to it. Well, I'm done with that. No, I mean, that's you really have to learn how to use and understand and not be trapped, not be caught, and then skillfully apply the thought processes. And it's when we see that more clearly that we have a certain wariness toward the thought process. You can see a build-up of, especially say we've been working on metta, loving kindness, as a practice, and you see the mental formation starting to sort of gain momentum of the sort of irritation, aversion, or a particular view point arising. How could they do that? And you sort of see, if I let that one go, I know where that one's going to go. I know where that ends. I'll turn my attention to loving kindness. I'll turn my attention to well wishing, and that I can counter that. I can work with that, and so that there's a by seeing that, say, seeing mental formations as empty, as hollow, it's not. You can't just push them away, but it's like, because they're empty and hollow, then I need to be very careful around this. I need to be really, really attentive. Consciousness is seen as, and the Buddha has us reflect on consciousness as a, he compares it to a magician or a conjurer, a conjurer's trick. And that the when we see and I think it's probably still the same in India now, where it's the Buddha's, in the marketplace and on the corner, and then there's a conjurer or a magician, a person doing magic tricks, and he's got a little crowd around him, and everybody's, and he's making a bit of money on it, and so, same thing is still going on 2,500 years down the road, and if one understands the nature of the conjurer's trick, how it's actually done, if you understand the mechanics behind it, then there's not the same excitement, there's not the same sort of fascination, there's not the same willingness to lay the money down to for them to repeat the trick again. So that that nature of consciousness is very similar. It takes these disparate experiences, contact with the senses, and then forms it into an experience. Sort of, yeah, he really said that. We form that consciousness of that experience happening, and then we remember it. And it's, but the actual consciousness, there's an agenda behind that as well. So that's we have to recognize the hook behind it. And as we do that, then of course, then we're able to set those things down. We're not ever going to be free of the five khandhas, in the sense of those five aggregates of being, but we can be free of the aggregates of being affected by clinging. And that's the most important part. Because we do need to rely on those five aggregates of being. That's how we live. That's how we accomplish things. That's how the Buddha was able to teach. It was five khandhas. After his awakening and enlightenment, if he said, well, that's it for these five khandhas, then we'd be out of luck. It was after the Buddha's enlightenment, it was like 45 years of carrying the khandhas around and teaching and establishing a dispensation that has lasted to this day. So that these this reflection on the khandhas is a really important aspect of understanding the nature of self, nature of attachment to self, nature of clinging, and then the nature of relinquishment, of letting go, and as we're able to attend to that letting go, then quite naturally, part of the response is certainly that sense of loving kindness. It's a natural result of seeing Dhamma, seeing the way things are. There's a sense of of loving kindness and compassion, a sense of not being trapped by the particular reactions that come up, but there's a sense of kindness. That's actually, remember, Thai monk Ajahn Jamnian saying that whenever anybody sort of comes to him with I've attained the Dhamma, I've had stream entry now, I'm no more rebirth in the lower realm for me. Really pleased with my practice now. And he said he usually find the occasion to say, well, so-and-so has been saying this about you. And they've been saying you're like this and you're like that. And I said, well, I was just wondering. They didn't see what sort of response there is, because if there's anger or that sense of getting upset, and how could they say that? And say, it's not a stream enter. They have it because it's again one isn't that sense of holding to identity. Is one of one of the hallmarks of sort of worldly existence, and the relinquishment of that identification process is one of the fetters that is dropped as a as a one who enters the stream of Dhamma. And so that being able to recognize that. Ajahn Chah did something similar to somebody who came to him and how good their practice was going and how they'd sort of been practicing really diligently and they finally had a breakthrough and they were really just quite, you know, confident now that this sort of clear sailing to arhantship. And you know, Ajahn Chah listened and he just sort of kind of grunted and said, that's better than be at the dog. And especially in Thai, you compare it to somebody to being a dog, and it's like, bad. So that person got extremely upset. And Ajahn Chah couldn't help sort of in relating it, sort of, you know, so much for his stream entry. That loving kindness, that inclination to well wishing, is an integral part of the Dhamma. It's just a so that, you know, it, as we cultivate loving kindness, you know, this is you know, it's not something that is separate from, say, practicing Dhamma, reflection on Dhamma. They're woven together, and they support each other, so that not only, you know, do we say cultivate loving kindness and bring it into being in order to help the sort of those establishing of wholesome states of consciousness, and sort of calm states of abiding, and laying a foundation for insight. But they're, because they are, they're helpful tools for creating that stability of mind, a brightness of mind that allows one to see Dhamma. But then also, as we reflect on Dhamma, investigating Dhamma, we also see that, well, it's also a result, a cause and result. They work together. They're interwoven. So that to be able giving attention to these qualities is something that allows us to it's like gaining inspiration in the Dhamma, gaining a confidence in the Dhamma. So I'll offer that for reflection this morning.